What does the W in George W. Bush stand for? Subtitled Climbing the Bush Family Tree. We, of course, are in the middle of a presidential election. It appears to be one that people are not very enthused about. I can understand that. They certainly have not been presented with a great deal of information in the media that would get somebody enthused about what's going on. At the same time, I think that, well, I couldn't say this is the most important election ever, but this is an extremely important election, and I think one of the things that's important about it is what people are not going to get if they don't make the right decision. It's not so much a question of voting for the right person so you get what you want, which I think is the approach that most people take perhaps unconsciously to a political race. Rather, this is going to be what you're going to get that you never imagined if you don't make the right decision. So this is kind of like walking along a tightrope, and on the one side of the tightrope is a great big vat of mud, and you might fall into the mud and you're going to get dirty and it's going to stain your clothes and you may have to take several showers afterward. The other side is filled with razor-sharp shards of broken glass, and you're going to be cut into little pieces and die in agony. So it may not be a very appetizing choice between the two, but it's important to make the right choice. And it's also possible to stay on the tightrope. But the conventional wisdom has it. Actually, the term conventional wisdom should be classed as an oxymoron, but the conventional wisdom has it that there really isn't much difference between the political parties today, and that there really is not much of a difference between George W. Bush, and Al Gore. I get very disturbed when they're both represented as centrists, or when political pundits of either the mainstream press or the so-called progressive political sector, to the extent that there is still such a thing or ever was, when they represent Bush and Gore as being of similar political character and of the same fabric, I think is not only unfair to those people that still place a certain amount of faith in the news media, but it's more than a little grotesque considering the profound differences between Al Gore and George W. Bush. George W. has been governor of Texas for, I think, about 8 years. I think he got elected the first time in 1992. In any event, that's all he has ever done politically is to be the governor of Texas, which I think in terms of Texas power flow goes down something like the governor's like 17th in terms of the most influential state officials. The Texas state legislature meets every other year, and generally their work is done by the end of May. So this is not a guy who has any experience serious legislative back rooming, so to speak. During the debates, I was struck by the sort of student council, you know, junior UN quality of George W.'s responses. At one point, the moderator asked him, he said, well, in the event of a global financial crisis, such as the one that overtook the world in the fall of 1998, what would you do? So George W. says, well, I'd call Alan Greenspan and gather all the facts. I mean, George, what the hell kind of a response? That's like an eighth grader, you know, in the event of on an essay test, in the event of a global financial, because this is somebody who hasn't done his homework, in the event of a global financial crisis, such as the type that overtook the world in the fall of 1998, how would you react? And he goes, I'd call Alan Greenspan and gather all the facts. First of all, Alan Greenspan wouldn't necessarily have all the facts. He's chairman of the Federal Reserve. He's not necessarily an economist. He does have a board of advisors, but, in the event of a global financial crisis, you can call Alan Greenspan until you're blue in the face. That's not necessarily going to be a whole lot of help. You're going to have to know what to do. But it's the nature of Bush's responses. There's a student council quality to it that's very disturbing. What I find very disturbing about that is that this guy is actually being presented as presidential timber for, I think, all of the humor that understandably has been circulated about the fact that this guy is not an intellectual giant has served to mask the real brutality that lies on the underside of the Republican Party. And when you get past the schmoozing and, you know, the nice one African-American observer described the Republican convention as a nationwide minstrel show. I mean, they had all these non-white faces up there parading literally in what was an act of theater for in order to convince a nation, much of whose population is now non-white, that they ought to vote for a bunch of rich, repressive, white, mostly male politicians who are then going to screw them up the expletive deleted, you know, for their trouble. The humor that's been circulated about George W.'s lack of intellectual acumen has served to mask, I think, the fact that this is a very cruel political legacy that he's carrying forward. And it's a political legacy that embraces, among other entities, Adolf Hitler and the Third Reich. It is utterly ruthless, and I think that people that are... this is not to be judgmental, but people that are not aware of the profound differences between George W. and Al Gore should really take stock of some of the information that I'm going to be presenting and to examine the history of the Bush family, to understand what the Bush family is, the political legacy to which George W. is heir, and just what we can reasonably expect as human beings if, in fact, this person were to be elected president of the United States. Because even though George W. himself does not have a long political history as an office holder, he's been governor of Texas, which is sort of low man on the office-holding totem pole, the fact of the matter is that George W. is an heir to a very significant political legacy. He is the namesake of a very, very powerful, very political family. And indeed, I think it is more than fair, I think it is necessary to evaluate George W. Bush in terms of his ancestors and his father in particular, because if one examines George W.'s advisors, it basically reads like a who's who of George Bush political advisors, that's George Herbert Walker Bush, his father, with a smattering of Reagan advisors thrown in. One of his top foreign policy advisors is Richard Armitage, heavily involved in the Iran-Contra machinations. Richard Cheney, of course, is vice president, was the defense secretary for a period of time under George Bush. Condoleezza Rice, the probable secretary of state, was a State Department advisor to George, actually was a State Department official under George Bush. And virtually all of George Walker Bush's, virtually all of W's political advisors had advised his father. And indeed, one of the rhetorical counterweights that has been presented in order to allay people's fears that George W. can't walk and chew gum at the same time has been that, well, he's going to have a tried and true advisory team, namely the people who had advised his father. So I think in terms of trying to evaluate George W. as a political entity, it is, as I said, not only fair but necessary to evaluate him as the standard bearer, as the torch bearer, so to speak, which I think would be better than standard bearer, of a, not only a political family, but of a political philosophy and of a social establishment in the United States that is very noble, which has been very destructive, and yet which, for some reason, not for some reason, they're very definite, but for which has been able to mask or else trivialize an awful lot of its shortcomings. So what I'm going to be doing is, in this first talk, is to try to analyze the political legacy of George W. Bush, to climb the Bush family tree, so to speak, and to try to give us a better assessment of just what this guy is really all about. Because all we're being presented with are sound bites in his sort of affable, you know, frat boy attitude with just enough naughtiness to where he referred to Adam Clymer of the New York Times as a major league a-hole. And so that just to show that he's a real guy who can, you know, cuss with the boys, you know, after having a few brewskis down at the How. The media has been keeping George Bush from us and has been structuring him in a way that is pulling the fangs and in a way is sort of sanitizing what the man is really all about. And I think sadly, certainly one should not minimize the impact of corporate power on political campaigns, including the Democratic Party and the politicians who run for it. But When I see discussion of both of Bush and Gore being virtually indistinguishable as political animals, I see that in the mainstream press. I hear a lot of talk on the left, for example, about people saying that, well, there are no real differences between the Democrats and the Republicans. One hears that on the right to a certain extent as well. The fact of the matter is that there are profound differences. And what I'm going to talk about is the legacy to which George W. is heir, and the legacy that we are going to be inheriting if, in fact, he gets elected president. I think a microcosm for understanding not only the Bush family, but understanding the forces that act through the Bush family, a microcosm, in a sense, could be thought, it could be a construct, I think, for understanding that, could be looked at in the 1988 presidential political campaign. Those who are said to be knowledgeable about George W. Bush have cited his role as one of the main officers in his father's successful presidential election campaign of 1988 as being one of the defining factors in convincing George W. that he would run for president as well. George W. was deeply involved with his father's election campaign in 1988. Indeed, the two people who managed George Herbert Walker Bush's 88 campaign were George W. and Roger Ailes, who went on to become Rush Limbaugh's producer. Which is very interesting when one considers the fact that George Herbert Walker Bush was defeated for re-election, Bill Clinton was then subjected to, is still being subjected to a years-long political diatribe and is being raked over the coals by people like Rush Limbaugh. And Rush Limbaugh spawned a whole host of imitators. And when one thinks that Roger Ailes, who along with George W. managed George Bush's 1988 campaign, when one thinks that considers that he was running George Bush and now he's running Rush Limbaugh, it really does not appear to be too much of a jump. In 1988, one of the stories that got buried during the course of the campaign was a story about a bunch of Third Reich collaborators and Central and Eastern European fascists who were working for George Bush's 1988 election campaign. This story hit the press for maybe two or three days, and the Central and Eastern European fascists who were being discussed were members of the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization, or Ethnic Heritage Council, as it ultimately came to be called when it was formally incorporated as a branch of the Republican Party. This basically was an organization whose development I'm going to be talking about during the course of this talk. It consisted of the residua of much of the Central and Eastern European fascist infrastructure, which not only was allowed to survive by the West during the Cold War because of its anti-communist sentiments, but elements of which were able to actually thrive in a political sense in the United States as a result of one of the many machinations that I'm going to be discussing later, something called the Crusade for Freedom. But it's worth knowing that in 1988, according to people familiar with George Bush's campaign, nothing got done in that campaign unless it was cleared with Roger Ailes and George W. Bush. Due to the, albeit attenuated, but bad press coverage about having some of these Nazis and overt fascists on his 1988 campaign, many of them had to resign working on Bush's 88 campaign. But it's worth noting that they could not have made it to Bush's campaign in the first place without the okay of George W. Bush, because he was one of the main architects of his father's election campaign in 1988. So that when one sees the Nazi and emigre milieu that I speak about so often present at working on George Bush's 1988 campaign, one has to understand that this necessarily has to have been cleared with George W. Bush. And I think in that relationship between George Herbert Walker Bush, his father, and in turn this fascist milieu from Europe, dating back to World War II and before, one can see a dynamic which in many ways embraces not only the political and social philosophy of the Bush family, but which could be said perhaps to be exemplary of the Bush family as a political entity. Now, as the talk develops, there are a few key words I think that people should keep in mind. As listeners who've heard the program are familiar with, I don't like the term conspiracy theory. It's a loaded term, and I think it conjures up a lot of connotations which are not necessarily useful in understanding how things work. This is not to say that there are not political conspiracies. Of course there are political conspiracies. But in terms of understanding how power is administered in the United States and elsewhere, I think a much more useful term is networking. And indeed, in terms of understanding the Bush family, in terms of understanding the Bush family tree, in terms of understanding George W. and the political legacy to which he is most definitely heir, I think the term networking is a very important term to keep in mind. I think the sociological term coined by C. Wright Mills, the power elite, is very important to keep in mind. I don't like the term ruling class, not only because of its Marxist connotations, but really it's not a class. It's not that big. It's more a power elite. I think also a term which is something of a cliche, but which should be borne in mind, and that is the Eastern establishment. But I think keeping in mind those three words and understanding the unfolding of the political legacy that I hope to illustrate for you, I think keeping those three words, those three terms in mind, networking, because we're most definitely going to be looking at networking. The power elite, because there is no family in the United States that are not members of the power elite, if not the Bushes. And also the Eastern establishment, because that Eastern establishment, really the Episcopalian elite, is one of the things that we're going to be looking at during the course of the talk this evening. There is a lot of discussion in conspiracy circles about Jewish banking conspiracies and things of this kind. You'll hear people talking about this group or that group. You know, well, who runs things? Well, I think the mafia run things. Well, one of the things that people who administer power have become quite good at is keeping things, keeping the truth concerning political reality away from people. People who are really good at administering power learn that keeping your name out of the papers can be one of the most effective ways of maintaining power. And the American power elite is Episcopalian. Now the Borman Flight Capital Organization that I speak about is gaining a lot of influence in this country, in part through their networking with the Episcopalian elite. But there's a book called The Power of Their Glory. It's by, I believe it's Kurt and Frederica, the last name is K-O-N-O-L-I-G-E. I'm not sure how that's pronounced, Conoliga or Conolig. I'm not sure how it's pronounced. The book is copyright 1978 by Wyden Books, and it's called The Power of Their Glory. And it talks about the Episcopalian, they call it a ruling class. I prefer the term power elite. And that's really who has been in charge here in the United States, are the Episcopalians. The Episcopalian Church is basically the American branch of the old Anglican Church, but the top Eastern universities, the Ivy League, and the Bushes are a Yale family. The elite Eastern prep schools that generally feed the Ivy League, and also the Seven Sisters, elite schools that at least used to be all female. That Eastern establishment and that power elite is primarily Episcopalian. And to give one an idea of just how solid and how explicit, albeit quiet, the continuity of Episcopalian power has been. When Dwight Eisenhower, who had been a five-star general and was a nationally acclaimed, internationally acclaimed war hero, when he was named to be president of Columbia University in, I believe it was 1950, maybe 1951, it was sort of his stepping stone to running for president of the United States, but when he was named as the president of Columbia University, there was a special meeting of the Board of Trustees of Columbia University to basically decide whether it was okay to have Eisenhower as president of Columbia University because he was not an Episcopalian. I don't know what his religious affiliation was. He was some Protestant denomination, mixed Swedish and German parentage, was a five-star general, a graduate of West Point, and yet the fact that he was not an Episcopalian was seen as such a potential stumbling block that there had to be a special meeting of the Board of Trustees of Columbia University to determine, and this was in the early 50s, this was well after Roosevelt, to determine whether it was acceptable to have a non-Episcopalian as a president of an Ivy League university. The Ivy League is Columbia, the University of Pennsylvania, Princeton, Yale, Harvard, Cornell, Dartmouth, Brown, and I may have forgotten one. I think I got them all. But though that and a few other those schools and a few other elite schools of the so-called Little Three, Amherst, Wesleyan, and Williams, the Seven Sisters, which used to be all female, and a series of prep schools that, as I said, feed these, are really sort of the forge in which the Eastern establishment and the American power elite are created. And that'll give you an idea of the extent to which the elite to which George W. Bush was born is very self-conscious. The Bushes are, surprise, surprise, Episcopalians. But in examining the evolution of the Bush family's legacy, one should not lose sight of the fact that, in the first place, George W. claims to be an outsider because he doesn't live in Washington, D.C. If there was ever a family or a group of people who are not outsiders but who are insiders with a capital I, it is the Bush family. And indeed, George W. would not be where he is if he were not an ultimate insider. It's very disturbing to me to read the analyses of voter sentiment. Well, perhaps we'll touch on this in the second talk, but I've seen several articles in the popular press about how men are overwhelmingly pro-Bush and how they can't stand Al Gore. And they were interviewing some of the men who were overwhelmingly pro-Bush, and they really couldn't come up with anything concrete except they thought Gore was a sissy. You know, they thought he was anti-gun, and one guy said he could see Al Gore breaking into tears. But when they interviewed about George W., they said they thought he was a man's man, and he'd really, you know, kind of pulled himself up by his bootstraps. He was a self-made individual, and in fact, this guy's never done anything on his own. In fact, if it could ever be said of someone that they were born with a silver swastika in their mouth, it's George W. Bush. But again, I'm not trying to whip a dead horse in this regard, but George W. is a very definite, explicit heir to a political legacy. And what I'm going to be doing is to try to outline, and I think that's the best I could do, some of the political relationships that have helped to form this world in the last half a century, the political dynamics that have governed this country in that same period of time, and to show the networking between some of the key figures that leads right on up to George W. Bush. Because a lot of people don't realize just how intertwined and how incestuous the American political establishment is, and the extent to which the Eastern establishment or the power elite is a very self-conscious, self-perpetuating, networking institution. The title of the lecture is, What does the W in George W. Bush stand for? Well, it stands for his great-grandfather, who was George Herbert Walker. He was named for the poet George Herbert. George Herbert Walker was a very influential businessman and financier, part of the Wall Street elite. George Herbert Walker was also one of the earliest and most prominent financial backers of a small Bavarian politician named Adolf Hitler, who perhaps some of you have heard of. Obviously, I'm being facetious. Hitler's three earliest prominent financial backers were Fritz Thyssen, that's spelled T-H-Y-S-S-E-N, and the Thyssen family are longtime political allies of the Bush family. Fritz Thyssen was a steel magnate. He was the heir to his father's firm. August Thyssen was his father. They had a steel-making firm, Vereinigte Stahlwerke, or United Steel. And Thyssen was the first prominent German industrialist to begin backing Hitler. He was joined by two prominent American industrialists and financiers at right about the same time. The American was Henry Ford, the famous industrialist whose motor company bears his name. Henry Ford was channeling money to Hitler in the early 1920s, and also George Herbert Walker. George Herbert Walker was supporting Adolf Hitler actively and financially by the early 1920s, by 1924. So in terms of understanding the political legacy to which George W. is heir, take a look at what the W stands for. The W stands for his great-grandfather, George Herbert Walker, whom some have termed Hitler's most important American financial backer. He certainly was one of the three early prominent industrial and financial figures to back Adolf Hitler, who was seen as something of riffraff by a lot of the power elites at the time. There were other reactionary and fascist political parties in Germany. Most of those tend to be favored rather than the Nazis early on by the power elite of Germany and elsewhere, simply because Hitler was seen as déclassé. He was seen as being, quote, working class, unquote, and not really the sort of person they wanted to quell the riffraff. In fact, the Nazis came to see, or those who backed the Nazis, came to see Adolf Hitler as a useful shill precisely because he was perceived as being one of the common people and somebody that the common people could relate to. Something I can't understand is why Adolf Hitler was seen as being something of a sex symbol. They wanted him to stay unmarried. This is part of the Nazi tactics because they wanted single women to develop crushes on him like he were some sort of movie matinee idol or a rock star. I don't know. I mean, tastes with regard to sexuality were very different in those days, but I find it very difficult to picture Hitler as a sex symbol. But of course, when they get him up on the monster rallies with the camera looking up at him and with the elevator shoes and the shoulder pads to make him look bulkier and taller, you know, perhaps. But in any event, it's worth noting that Hitler, although reactionary, was initially seen as being low class and tasteless and not sufficiently elite to lead German reaction. It's one of the reasons why a lot of the industrialists and financiers got on the Hitler bandwagon relatively late. Not so Fritz Thyssen, who climbed, he was the first prominent German man of money to begin supporting Adolf Hitler, was doing so by the early 20s. He was joined by American industrialist Henry Ford of the Ford Motor Company and also by George Herbert Walker, the man for whom George W. Bush is named, also for whom his father is named. His father's name is George Herbert Walker Bush, also named for that same individual, George Herbert Walker Bush's grandfather, George W.'s great-grandfather. But it's worth noting that in terms of analyzing the political legacy to which George W. is heir, is that he was named for his great-grandfather who was backing Hitler by the early 1920s. Some of the main corporate entities that George Herbert Walker was involved with, that were involved with the financing of Adolf Hitler, and the story of the channeling of money to Hitler and Mussolini is something that I've taken up in other lectures and other broadcasts. Due to limitations of time, I'm not going to be able to detail that. But it's worth noting that because of the anti-communist, anti-labor, and pro-eugenic stance of the Nazis, they were viewed with great favor by, by many of the powerful and influential people in the world, because they were seen as a bulwark against socialism, a bulwark against the Soviet Union, and beyond that, their anti-Semitic and pro-eugenics stance was also looked upon with great favor. Some of the main corporate entities that George Herbert Walker was involved with were the Brown Brothers Harriman and Company, the Hamburg America Line, which was a prominent shipping firm, which also served as a major vehicle for German espionage and propaganda in the United States. In the late World War II period and post-World War II period, the Hamburg America Line also served as a vehicle for the Nazi flight capital program established under Martin Bormann. That would suggest at least the distinct possibility that the Bush family may have been involved as American players with the Bormann Flight Capital Organization. Another of the Walker companies, or the Bush family companies we could think of them as being, is the Silesian American Corporation. And one of the people that George Herbert Walker brought in as one of his aides and as one of his collaborators in administering these business affairs was Prescott Bush Sr. Now, Prescott Bush Sr. is the grandfather of George W. Bush, the father of his father, George Herbert Walker Bush. I'll just refer to him maybe as George H.W.B. And Prescott Bush, who was the son-in-law of George Herbert Walker, became deeply involved with Brown Brothers Harriman and Company, Silesian American Corporation, Hamburg America Line, and other corporate entities that were involved with doing business with Hitler and actually serving as proxies for Hitler in a propaganda and espionage sense in the United States. Ultimately, as the true nature of the Nazi regime became clear and as the public relations value of backing Hitler or even doing business with Hitler began to decline rapidly, the Bush corporate entities were ultimately masked in holding companies, and they were masked by a Wall Street lawyer who also was going to figure prominently in much of the discussion this evening. And this was a fellow named Alan Dulles. Alan Dulles, along with his brother John Foster Dulles, was a partner with Sullivan and Cromwell, one of the main Wall Street law firms. And Alan Dulles ultimately served as the cloaker, so to speak, to help restructure the various corporate entities that the Bush family were involved with in such a way as to mask the true nature of their business dealings with Adolf Hitler. Specifically, many of the Bush properties were folded into something called the Harriman 15, which is one of the holding companies set up by Alan Dulles, a powerful Wall Street lawyer. We should also note at right about this time, one of the main business people, he was really an investment professional involved with promoting investment in Germany. This would have been pre-Nazi Germany. It later continued as Nazi Germany because the investment policies were continuous from the pre-Hitler period through the Hitler period. But that was a fellow named William H. Draper, Jr. And in this regard, William H. Draper was working with Dillon Reed, a major investment firm in Wall Street. And bear that name in mind because we're going to come back to General Draper, as he later became known, and the Draper family. And bear in mind the term that I cited earlier, the concept of networking, because really what we're going to be looking at in looking at the evolution of George W. as a political entity, as a political animal, is we're going to be looking at the networking which has ultimately spawned George W. Bush. Despite the efforts of Alan Dulles, many of the corporate entities with which George Herbert Walker and his son, Prescott Bush Sr., were involved with were confiscated by the alien property custodian when war broke out between the United States and Germany. Specifically, the Silesian American Corporation and Hamburg America were basically seized over by the alien property custodian. I do not know if Brown Brothers Harriman was actually seized by the alien property custodian, but it was another of the Bush companies that was notorious for its business dealings with Adolf Hitler. But it's worth noting that George W.'s great-grandfather, his grandfather and great-grandfather, Prescott Bush Sr., and George Herbert Walker, the man for whom he is named, were deeply involved with the American financial and industrial machinations that helped to spawn Hitler and Mussolini. It's also worth noting, and some people have talked about the Skull and Bones Society as an entity in and of itself that is worth dealing with. I think Skull and Bones, which is an elite senior society at Yale, it's perhaps the most prestigious and the most mysterious of the secret societies at Yale. The thing that's worth noting about Skull and Bones, the thing that's most significant about it, is the very concept of networking. The Skull and Bones is a senior society at Yale. If you've ever visited the Yale campus, the building itself looks very much like an old Egyptian sarcophagus. It has no windows and it has a sort of a Egyptian architectural bent to it. But I remember when I visited Yale, when I was considering applying to Yale as a wee tyke, I remember looking at this and wondering, what the hell is this? I mean, Yale is a beautiful campus, sort of a typical New England campus architecture. It's got all these red brick buildings with the white stucco, and it's a very typical Eastern campus architecture. And then here's this entity which looks like it should have been housing a field gun in Normandy beachhead or something. It looked like a gun emplacement or a sarcophagus. It's a tomb. It's been called the tomb. Its nickname is the tomb. And every year, 15 seniors at Yale are tabbed as bonesmen, so to speak. Now I guess they also admit women. But the Skull and Bones is really a networking vehicle. And what's interesting about Skull and Bones is the extent to which bonesmen, as they are colloquially known, have been able to network together, and the extent to which the power elite of this country and the Eastern establishment resulted from Skull and Bones, but have certainly incorporated people involved with Skull and Bones to a large extent. Now, Prescott Bush Sr. was a member of Skull and Bones. That's the same Prescott Bush Sr. who was working with George Herbert Walker, with companies like Brown Brothers Harriman, Silesian American Corporation, and Hamburg America Line, which was supporting Hitler. Prescott Bush Sr. was reliably reported to have... let me backtrack, and I'll relate a bit of anecdotal evidence. Now, this is hearsay, it's anecdote, and I can't speak for what I'm about to discuss, but in the early 1980s, I was approached by someone who has since proved very credible and very reliable, and this person asked me if I knew much about the Skull and Bones. And I said, no, I knew it was one of the secret societies at Yale. I knew that George Bush was a member of it. And anyway, this guy claimed, and I will not state this as being anything more than an allegation. This guy claimed that Skull and Bones was deeply involved with certain occult practices and rituals. It is an elite society at Yale, and it is a vehicle for networking. He said that it was far more than that. He claimed, and this was 1983, I'd never heard any of this, and I knew of the Skull and Bones, but I didn't know anything. I didn't realize there was anything particularly sinister about it, although I certainly can't say as I thought much of their taste in architecture. But this guy claimed, first of all, he said that the initiation ceremony for the Skull and Bones entails lying in a coffin, confessing one's sexual history, and then engaging in a form of sexual ritual in which the initiate has to masturbate over a swastika flag while lying in a coffin. This after confessing their sexual sins, but that to qualify in the first place, you have to be tabbed as a bonesman. And he said that each prospective Skull and Bones candidate to qualify has to rob the grave of a famous person and then bring the remains back to the Skull and Bones headquarters, where the remains are stored in the crawl space at Skull and Bones. Now, you know, I said, okay, interesting. This guy claims to have, he said he had an associate who had infiltrated the Skull and Bones, had photographed the remains in the crawl space, you know, these remains of famous people. I basically said, well, interesting, if true. He said the person could not get the book published. And I said, well, you know, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, if you can get me some credible documentation, I can talk about this. I have not seen of what I have just discussed credibly documented. However, in the press and in books and in newspaper coverage, journalistic coverage of Skull and Bones, to the extent that there has been some, I have seen some things emerging which I never expected to see in the media. One of the things this guy told me about was an allegation that Prescott Bush Sr. had robbed Geronimo's grave, Geronimo the famous Apache chief, and that he had brought the remains back to Skull and Bones where they were used in rituals. I said, okay, well, interesting. And I don't want to be misunderstood as endorsing this person's view. I simply am presenting that because to me it was one of a number, you know, it was Scary Stories Volume 3, you know, Tales from the Crypt, so to speak, quite literally. The interesting thing is that now a number of tidbits from what this guy has told me have since emerged. One, apparently it is well known that the initiation rites of Skull and Bones do involve, the initiation rite does involve a lying in a coffin and a confessing of one's sexual history. Whether they have to masturbate over a swastika flag, as this guy alleged, I have no idea. Whether each prospective bonesman, or perhaps now boneswoman, has to rob a grave and bring the remains back, I can't say. But the evidence at this point suggests very strongly that, in fact, while stationed as a military intelligence officer at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, Prescott Bush Sr. was indeed involved with robbing Geronimo's grave and bringing the remains back to the Skull and Bones headquarters, where Geronimo's remains have been used in rituals at the Skull and Bones Society. In fact, the San Carlos Apache have been very exercised about this and claim to have credible documentation that this is true, and they have been trying to get Geronimo's remains returned to the grave at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. Again, I'm not claiming that what this informant told me is true, but I never expected to see any element of this appearing in the press, and now the publicity concerning Prescott Bush Sr.'s robbing of Geronimo's grave is quite well established. There was even an article in the New York Observer by a guy named Ron Rosenbaum, who wrote an article about Skull and Bones some years ago, talking about the Skull and Bones rituals and how they were based on the rites of certain 19th century Bavarian Masonic lodges. And it now turns out that Prescott Bush Sr. does appear to have robbed Geronimo's grave. It's interesting in terms of understanding the difference in of the political heritage to which Al Gore is heir and the political heritage to which George Bush is heir. Can you imagine if Gore's grandfather had robbed a grave, Geronimo's grave, or anybody, if he'd robbed Shirley Temple isn't dead yet, but robbed anybody's grave and brought the remains back to be used in occult rituals? I mean, my God, we've just seen a 6-year, $52 million investigation into nothing, the Whitewater case. And what they came up with after all of this was a blowjob. Basically they have Monica Lewinsky giving Bill Clinton a blowjob. I mean, then this is the end result of 6 years and $52 million. Well, I mean, I think that was a foolish and indiscreet thing for Bill Clinton to do. At the same time, you know, when one thinks about all the hoopla about this, and then the only reason that even got introduced into the political debate was because Jennifer Flowers was ruled by the courts as being able to sue Bill Clinton while he was in office. That's how that whole thing came on the front burner. But can you imagine if Clinton or Gore's grandfather had robbed somebody's grave? Can you imagine the flap? I mean, they'd never be able to show their face. And yet, you know, all Clinton did was to get a blowjob from Monica Lewinsky. You know, I mean, if he'd been a Republican, first place, she was over the age of consent. Beyond that, she was still alive. You know, if he'd been a Republican, probably would have had sexual relations with her corpse or something like that. But it's really interesting to see some of the things that get swept under the rug. And apparently, whether or not the allegations that I heard about what the Skull and Bones actually do at their initiation ceremonies are not as accurate, there are some pretty disturbing indications of some, shall we say, unorthodox sexual practices, and that's not meant to be moralizing about that. But the Bush family name does crop up in connection with allegations of ritual pedophile activity, and the names of both George Herbert Walker Bush and also people involved with Prescott Bush Jr. That's not Prescott Sr. who robbed Geronimo's grave, but Prescott Bush Jr., the brother of George Herbert Walker Bush. Both of their names crop up in connection with some of these, with this milieu, with this nexus. We're going to talk about that as the talk develops. But in terms of understanding networking, and in terms of also perhaps seeing the 1988 campaign as something of a microcosm, George Herbert Walker Bush, now the son of Prescott Bush Sr., the bonesman who, along with his father-in-law, George Herbert Walker, was helping to finance and also do business with Adolf Hitler. George Herbert Walker Bush went to Yale, became a member of Skull and Bones, like his father, Prescott Sr., and two of George Herbert Walker Bush's classmates, a fellow named Howard Weaver, and also a guy named Samuel Sloan Walker Jr. I don't know whether that's any relation to George Herbert Walker. These were two of the 15 bonesmen in George Herbert Walker Bush's class. They went on to work in the intelligence community for Alan Dulles's Fascist Freedom Fighters program, as authors John Loftus and Mark Ahrens have termed it. Specifically, Walker and Weaver went to work for something called the Free Europe Committee and the Free Europe Press Committee. This basically was a State Department intelligence front which was heavily involved with not only rehabilitating and utilizing Nazi and Eastern European fascist collaborators from World War II, many of the Galen ABN milieu that I talk about, but they were also involved with bringing some of these people into the United States under the auspices of the Crusade for Freedom. But again, in terms of understanding networking, taking a look at the Skull and Bones as one of the vehicles through which some of this networking takes place, I think is useful. And taking a look at George Herbert Walker Bush, he followed his father's footsteps to Yale, followed his father's footsteps into Skull and Bones. Two of his classmates go on to become deeply involved with the intelligence community, working with the same Nazi and fascist emigre milieu that I spend so much time talking about. And then the networking, that word again, and some of the Skull and Bones connections, some of the old boy network that we're looking at here, manifested itself in the very beginning of George Bush's, certainly his business career, because George Herbert Walker Bush is an oil man, having begun his own oil company, Zapata Oil. It also appears to have been the genesis of George Bush's career with the intelligence community as well. People like Victor Marchetti, a former Soviet analyst with the Central Intelligence Agency, among others, have opined that in all likelihood, George Herbert Walker Bush was recruited into the CIA and the intelligence community directly from Yale, and that his first job in the petroleum industry was also a job working with the intelligence community. His first job, that is to say George Herbert Walker Bush's first job after graduating from Yale, was to work for Dresser Industries. That's just like in dresser drawers, Dresser. That was the largest oil field drilling company in the world at that time. I believe it still is, although now it's a subsidiary company. We're going to talk about what it's a subsidiary. Actually, I won't be mysterious. It's now a subsidiary of Halliburton Oil, whose CEO is Dick Cheney, who's running for vice president under George Walker Bush. If I get my George Bushes confused at some point, somebody correct me, throw something not too hard or too sharp, and preferably not, don't throw it too hard, but just Otherwise, call it to my attention, because it's possible that I may be getting some of the, I won't be able to see the forest for the bushes, because we've got so many of them here.